Welcome, everybody. It's good to see everybody. So it's kind of amazing to me, but we only have two more classes in this series of ours, today and then next Sunday. And I can't believe how quickly this is all going. When I started planning these classes, I was really worried about running out of material to cover. And now it seems that we're just running out of time. So I was thinking about how, you know, as I'm preparing for the classes, I sometimes feel like, well, you know, we could just continue meeting like this every week forever and be perfectly fine, right? So, and I was kind of doing a little, trying to take a view of the sessions and to see if I was actually still on track, because there was a track in my mind anyway. So the plan at the beginning was twofold. It was to look at Dogen's writing about the practice of Zazen, and specifically about Shikantaza, just sitting, you know, and to ask this question, you know, what is it and what makes it different from other forms of meditation? And the good news is, I think we've accomplished this. We have accomplished this in our study of Fukan Sazengi. So this is a huge relief to me that we've actually accomplished one of my goals for this class. And you know, all of this talk about goallessness, you know, it's like, because I am actually one of the most, you know, sort of goal-oriented people I know. I am relentlessly goal-oriented, which is why this practice is so important for me, because it actually helps me sort of balance and to sort of sit in that tension between, you know, goal orientation and goallessness. And so I'll come back to that later on. The second thing, my second goal was to look at the relationship between Zazen practice and different types of creative expression, and see what we could learn about both. And you know, so some of you are new today, but I think you know, I recommended that during the period of time that we take up some kind of creative practice. And some of you I know were able to do this and some of you haven't, and that's just fine. Either way is fine. So for people who are here for the first time, that's great too. And anyway, today what I'd like to do is to wrap up with this Fukan Zazengi, the text that we've been reading, recommending Zazen to all people, and then just say a few more things about that, and then I'd like to kind of shift focus and focus more on the creative expression off the cushion. But before I do that, I want to read something to you that Flo turned me on to. It's from a book by Eric Frome, and also D.T. Suzuki and Richard DiMartino, called Zen Buddhism and Psychoanalysis, and it was published in 1957. And so the passage that I'm going to read was written by D.T. Suzuki. Okay, and for those of you who might not know, D.T. Suzuki was a Japanese scholar who came to the U.S. in the 1920s, probably, right? Yeah, and lived in New York for many years and taught about, he practiced Rinzai Zen, but he lived in New York for many years and you know, wrote a lot about Japanese culture, Japanese arts, and about Japanese religion. And there's a beautiful YouTube video, little movie about him. I think that's sort of freely available. It's a little documentary about him, and it's really quite moving, and so I recommend that. Anyway, so from Zen Buddhism and Psychoanalysis. Okay, and this is a little bit long, but I think it's kind of nice. We cannot all be expected to be scientists, but we are so constituted by nature that we can all be artists. Not indeed artists of special kinds, such as painters, sculptors, musicians, poets, etc., but artists of life. This profession, quote, artists of life, may sound new and quite odd, But in point of fact, we are all born artists of life, and, not knowing it, most of us fail to be so. And the result is that we make a mess of our lives, asking, what is the meaning of life? Are we not facing blank nothingness? After living 78 or even 90 years, where do we go? Nobody knows, etc., etc. I am told that I am told that most modern men and women are neurotic on this account. But the Zen man, isn't that great? The Zen man. It's hyphenated, by the way. It's like a superhero. The Zen man, you know. The Zen man can tell them that they all have forgotten that they are born artists, creative artists of life, and that as soon as they realize this fact and truth, they will all be cured of neurosis or psychosis or whatever name they have for their trouble. What then is meant by being an artist of life? Artists of any kind, as far as we know, have to use one instrument or another to express themselves, to demonstrate their creativity in one form or another. The sculptor has to have stone or wood or clay, and the chisel or some kind of tool to impress his ideas on the material. But an artist of life has no need of going out of himself. All the material, all the implements, all the technical skills that are ordinarily required are with him from the time of his birth, perhaps even before his parents gave him birth. And this is unusual, extraordinary, you may exclaim. But when you think about this for a while, you will, I am sure, realize what I mean. If you do not, I will be more explicit and tell you this. The body, the physical body we all have, is the material corresponding to the painter's canvas, the sculptor's wood or stone or clay, the musician's violin or flute, the singer's vocal cords. And everything that is attached to the body, such as the hands, the feet, the trunk of the body, the head, the viscera, the nerves, the cells, thoughts, feelings, senses, everything indeed that goes to make up the whole personality is both the material on which and the instruments with which the person molds his creative genius into conduct, into behavior, into all forms of action, indeed to life itself. To such a person, his life reflects every image he creates out of his inexhaustive source of the unconscious. To such, his every deed expresses originality, creativity, his living personality. There is in it no conventionality, no conformity, no inhibitory motivation. He moves just as he pleases. His behavior is like the wind, with which bloweth as it listeth. He has no self encased in his fragmentary, limited, restrained, egocentric existence. He is gone out of this prison. One of the great Zen masters of the Tang says, with a man who is master of himself, wherever he may be found, he behaves truly to himself. This man I call the true artist of life. So, I think that's true for all of us, no matter whether we consider ourselves artists or writers or even if we're women. And I love this idea of the artist of life, even if I have a bit of a problem with the kind of narrow gender assumptions. Zen man, you know. So anyway, today, thank you, Flo, because I thought that was a lovely and interesting sort of perspective to see something that was written in the 1950s. And today, what I'd like to talk about is I'd like to talk about effort. Okay, and throughout the class, we've been talking about this question of Dogen's question of original enlightenment or hongaku. You know, why, if we're by nature enlightened Buddhas, do we need to practice at all? And at the heart of this question is the problem of effort. And at the end of last week, I suggested that we explore our effort in our home practice. We talked about the paradox that's at the heart of Fukan Zazengi. You know, why is effort necessary if the teaching is freely available? You know, why polish the mirror if it's free of dust? Why search for an answer if we already have it? And, you know, on one hand, Dogen exhorts us to make this effort, citing the examples of Shakyamuni Buddha, who sat for 6 years, or Bodhidharma, who sat for 9 years. But on the other hand, he's telling us to stop trying so hard, you know, to stop searching for phrases and chasing after words, to stop conscious endeavor, to stop analytic introspection, and to stop, indeed, trying to become a Buddha. So, on one hand, he's giving us very precise instructions about where and how to sit, how to align our body and mind. And on the other hand, he's just telling us to take the backward step and to practice just this. On one hand, he tells us that Zazen is all about enjoyment and ease, you know, the Dharma gate of peace, of repose, of bliss. And if we relax, the true Dharma will emerge of itself. And yet, elsewhere, he tells us to engage in Zazen as if we're saving our heads from fire. On one hand, we're perfect Buddhas just as we are, and on the other hand, we could use a little improvement. So, this seems to be a paradox. This seems to be a kind of dualistic contradiction, but maybe it's not. And I think here is where we can get a kind of a fresh perspective on this if we look at it from the point of view of the arts. If we look at this. You know, paradox of practice enlightenment from the point of view of the arts. You could say that the artistic equivalent of hongaku, or original enlightenment, is natural talent, right? But in the arts, there's no sense of opposition between practice and talent, right? I mean, Caravaggio might have been endowed with enormous natural talent, but this talent won't express itself unless he, you know, picks up a brush and paints. Shakespeare might have prodigious natural gifts, literary gifts, but if he doesn't write plays, then those gifts can't be given, nor can they be received. So art must be practiced by its very definition in order to be art. You know, plays must be written, paintings must be painted, music must be played. And all of these different disciplines, all of these different practices require enormous effort. You know, and there doesn't seem to be a problem with that. Equally obvious, I think, is that effort starts with the self. Okay, and this sounds simplistic, but it explains why our relationship with effort is often so fraught and so complicated. You know, it's because our relationship with ourselves is fraught and complicated. So, you know, when we're just starting out in our artistic practice, there's a lot of self-consciousness involved. And I think that self-consciousness very often gets in our way, and it can even stop us right from the start. And I'm sure, you know, we've all felt this. You know, the first time you sit down with a pen or a paintbrush, you know, and you resolve to make something, and you stare at the blank page, and, you know, suddenly you find yourself too self-conscious to kind of go there, right? It just seems too silly or too pretentious, or, you know, you're afraid of making a mistake or writing something foolish, you know, and all of the demons start to arise at that point, you know, making things very uncomfortable. And at that point, you know, unless we make this huge effort to overcome that fear and that discomfort and to, you know, actively, you know, grapple with and make friends with our demons, we'll simply give up, right? It's much easier. It's always much easier to get up from the desk and walk away and go clean the refrigerator or go answer email. And, you know, we probably, too, remember a similar feeling when we first started sitting Zazen. You know, it's like, oh, this is weird. You know, I'm not sure about this. You know, I'm not doing it right. My knees hurt. I can't stop thinking. Maybe I can slip out during Kinin. But then, you know, you make an effort and you continue, and little by little you start to gain some skills and a sense of ease, right? And this is when another kind of self-consciousness arises and kicks in, you know. You know, it's like, oh, wow, you know, I just wrote a short story. It's not bad. You know, maybe I can get it published. Maybe I can be a writer, you know, or a painter or a singer or something like that. So the ego becomes attached to it, you know, the sense of self becomes activated. Or in the case of spiritual practice, you know, you make an effort and sit for a few months or years and, you know, you're like thinking, not thinking. Oh, wow, not thinking. Cool. Ah, damn, thinking, you know. So it's the same, it's parallel, I think, you know, it's a parallel kind of thing. But if you continue to practice and you start to, I think what happens is that little by little you start to experience moments when you really do forget the self. And the practice starts to practice you. Your original gift starts to emerge as paintings or poems or songs or compassionate insight. And it grows deeper and stronger and more subtle. And it goes beyond the self and it starts to interpenetrate with the world. And even so, you still have to continue. You know, you still have to continue to make that supreme effort, returning to the keyboard or to the brush or to the cushion, simply because your art requires it. Expression is what art requires in order to live on through us. This is the art of art, and it's also the art of Zazen. And Norman talks about Zazen as the practice of return. And I think this is this applies, I think this is true, and I think it applies equally to the arts. It's just that simple practice of coming back again and again. You know, just letting go of judgment, coming back again and again, no matter what. And not for the sake of accomplishing anything in particular, but just because that's what we do. Creativity exists for its own sake. You know, we express art for art's sake. We do Zazen for Zazen's sake. Or perhaps it's more accurate to say we do these things for everyone's sake, everyone and everything. And I think that's why in Zen we actualize our original enlightenment through our Zazen as well as through our Bodhisattva vows. On one hand, you know, every moment is perfect just as it is. You know, a sort of moment of suchness. And on the other hand, you know, instead of patting ourselves on the back about it, we make these impossible vows, right? We vow to save, you know, all innumerable beings, to end all inexhaustible delusions, to enter the boundless Dharma gates, and to become the unsurpassable Buddha way. We make these impossible vows continuously. And to get back to this, you know, this idea of effort then, you know, the story of the Buddha's life and enlightenment is kind of the Ur narrative illustrating the duality of effort and no effort. And I'm sure everyone is familiar with this, you know, about how the Buddha grew up in, you know, extreme luxury and self-indulgence, and eventually, you know, he left the palace and then he practiced extreme asceticism and self-denial. And finally, you know, he found a middle way in between those, kind of splitting the difference between the two extreme poles of effort and no effort. And Dogen, I think, does something similar, but it seems to me also to be a little different, because instead of splitting the difference between the two poles, he sort of expands and widens his view to include both of them, right? So there's no separation. In Dogen's view, both extremes are not only both okay, you know, they're both true and necessary. Effort is necessary, and no effort is necessary. Goals are necessary, and goallessness is also necessary. Original enlightenment is true, and you must practice as if your head's on fire. And so what Dogen seems to be advocating there is a complete and kind of all-inclusive embrace of this duality, which goes back to the kind of both-and paradigm that I mentioned earlier on in earlier talks. And I think that Dogen's this all-inclusive, no-separation practice is actually quite radical. And, you know, it applies not just to the effort that we make in our spiritual practices, but also to the way we approach our work and our lives and all of the things that we do that we call creative. And it applies not just to the way that we approach the effort, no-effort duality, but also to all duality, anything that we perceive of as duality. And I think that, to go back to Fukan Zazengi, I think what Dogen is trying to show, what he's trying to demonstrate in that text and in many of his teachings is, you know, he's trying to show us or to lead us and teach us how to abide in that non-dual state of all-inclusive, no separation. You know, sort of acknowledging the extremes, the polarities, but not, you know, not seeking some kind of resolution to that. So, you know, in Fukan Zazengi, he talks about effort and no effort, knowing and not knowing, thinking and not thinking, right? And if we, you know, and in through our Zazen practice, what we do is we learn to kind of sit and hold that duality, you know, in this place of all-inclusive non-separation. And by doing that, what we start to feel, and I think we feel it in our bodies, is, you know, the sort of, I want to use the word tension. There's a kind of a tension there, but it's a creative tension. It's a generative tension, right? It's a kind of vital tension. And, you know, on the cushion, you know, sitting in the midst of that duality, we start to, you know, experience that, we start to appreciate it, and we start to, we learn to tolerate it, right? And so, you know, the effort, no effort is something that we've talked about, and we'll kind of circle back around to this, but I was thinking about knowing and not knowing, and the tension between knowing and not knowing, and how, you know, I know from my writing practice that this tension here is exactly what gives birth to a novel. Right, you know, when I start a novel, when I start writing, maybe I'll start with a little piece of dialogue or a character will kind of pop into my head, and I start to immediately have questions about that, you know, the character, and I want to know more. Right, so immediately, you know, as soon as something, an idea comes in, right, you want to know more. But, you know, I think the creative process then is learning to sit with that state, you know, sit in that state of not knowing for long enough so that you don't cut off possibilities prematurely, right? You need to be able to sit in that state, so allowing all of the possibilities to be open, right? Knowing that, you know, that you know certain things, but you want to know other things, and it's a you know, there is a sense of kind of tension and aliveness in that space, and so sitting there long enough, little by little, the story starts to emerge. Thinking and not thinking is another one that I feel that I'm quite familiar with in the novel writing process, even though it sounds like novel writing is all about thinking. But I know that when I try to sort of think through my plot tangles and my storylines, creating kind of, you know, diagrams and outlines and things like that, very often what I'll do is I'll think myself into some kind of stalemate. Right, it you know, things close down very quickly, and so this is exactly when it's time to stop thinking. Right, it's time to stop thinking and kind of take a backward step away from that, and practice the age-old, time-honored practice of noodling, right, just, you know, wool gathering. Right, and this is, you know, this is different from watching Game of Thrones, you know, or answering email, you know, it's that, you know, it's that, you know, that state of just sitting still, you know, it's not Zazen, but it's sitting still, maybe with a cat on your lap, you know, watching, and the cat and you are watching the birds, you know, outside the window, or, you know, walking on the beach and looking for stones with, you know, circles on them or something. It's that, you know, or sitting in a cafe and you know, kind of gently eavesdropping on the couple sitting next to you, you know, and kind of wondering, I wonder if that's going to last, you know. you know, these are the kinds of, you know, these are the kinds of moments where you're not really thinking, you're not thinking, you're just kind of, you know, you're wool gathering. You're sort of just sitting in a kind of an open, receptive state to the world, right? In that kind of open, receptive relationship with the world. Another, you know, one of these dualities that's particularly meaningful to me is the patience and impatience. And Michael talked about this a couple weeks ago. And, you know, Norman once again maintains that patience is perhaps, you know, one of the most important spiritual virtues. And I think that's true. And I also know that I'm probably one of the most impatient people I know. You know, it's okay. It's not my fault. I get it from my mother. but you know, I used to really think that impatience was a problem. You know, but these days I think I've actually begun to appreciate it. Partly because when I get impatient, it's like mom's coming, you know, for a visit. So that's kind of nice. But, you know, I also realize that, you know, without my impatience, without my mother's impatience to kind of goad me on, I'd probably just be sitting around, you know, doing like nothing, you know, just whatever. But it's because there is that sense of impatience there as well, that I you know, and balanced with the patience that is required in order to write long-form fiction, which can take years and decades even. It's that balance there. It's you know, trying to find that balance and sort of appreciating, you know, that we, you know, sort of move back and forth between these, you know, between these poles, and at the same time we can widen out, you know, our embrace of this and hold them both. And I really think that that's what we're practicing on the cushion. You know, that's what we're practicing in Zazen. So those are just some of my kind of most favorite and fertile dualities. And I guess, you know, the practice suggestion I think that comes out of this is just that, you know, to acknowledge that sometimes that tension feels a little bit uncomfortable. You know, sometimes it feels uncomfortable being kind of pulled between those poles of, you know, wanting to know something or wanting, you know, one of the things that that writers, it's very funny, you know, very often beginning writers, you know, they say they want to write, but actually what they want is to have written. Right, and you know, and that really is the patience, you know, the patience impatience duality, right? And so to hold those both with a kind of generosity of spirit and a kind of an equanimity, you know, it's a very creative and fertile and generative kind of tension, and so when you start to feel pulled towards, you know, towards wanting resolution, that's a good kind of like the bell going off. You know, it's a good moment to, you know, to realize, oh, I'm you know, I'm feeling the need for resolution here, and then to take a step back away from that, to use that as a kind of a mindfulness prompt, step back away from it, and see if there's anything in that moment of kind of, you know, tension that's useful, right? And sit with that, right? Rather than trying to, you know, go for the either or, you know, resolution. And I think this is really what, you know, once again, this is what Zazen teaches us, you know, how to stay in that place of tension, alert and awake, you know, and to relax there. Because, I mean, you know, the whole thing about tension is that it brings up a kind of an energy. So, you know, to breathe with that and to relax there. And I think this is really what Dogen is talking about when he talks about the art of Zazen. You know, this is the art of Zazen. But I would also say that you could flip that, you know, and say that this is also the Zazen of art, right? So that it can work. It can work both ways. So that's what I have to say about this. And what I'd like to do, I think, is to, you know, to do what we normally do and break up into groups of three. And I'd like to just give you some discussion questions. Last week, I asked you to, you know, think about your relationship with effort. And so maybe in the small groups we could just, you know, take a little time to talk about that. And specifically the questions that I'm thinking about is, you know, what is your relationship with effort, both in your Zen practice, but also in your creative practice, at work, at home, you know, wherever it is that you either make effort or don't make effort. Right. Actually, the practice suggestion last week was more specific than that. It was, if you feel during, you know, in your practice period endeavors, if you feel that you are perhaps making too much effort, try dialing it back a little bit. If you feel that you are not making enough effort, try, you know, raising the volume a little bit. So that was the suggestion last week. So you can certainly talk about that as well. And another sort of seed for discussion would be what kinds of polarities or dualities, right, are meaningful to you? You know, what kinds of dualities or polarities do you find creative? What kind do you find uncomfortable? You know, so that might be something else you can talk about. And then, of course, the Suzuki Roshi, you know, you are perfect just as you are, and you could use a little improvement, you know. Which side are you on? You know? Okay, so those are just that's a little bit of you know, food for discussion. And I think what I think it would be nice to do this in a kind of a structured way. So we'll take turns. I'll ring the bell to start. One person starts talking, and the other, you know, people in your group will just sit and listen in a receptive way without, you know, without interrupting or without commenting or providing feedback, just really listening. If the person who is speaking runs out of things to say before I ring the bell, then that's, you know, that's fine. You can just sit there and sit zazen, and maybe something else will arise. And then, so after a few moments of, after a few minutes have passed, then I'll ring the bell, and then the next person can go, and we'll do the same thing for the third person, and then we can all come back together. Then you can sort of talk in the group after each person has had their turn. Then talk in the group, and then we'll all come back together.
Do you want to specifically reference any creative or expressive practice we've been?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And this certainly, you know, to talk about, you know, if you have engaged in a creative practice during this practice period, during this class, then please, you know, please talk about that. That would be great. That would be great. Good. So why don't we? People need to take a break? Are we? Okay. No. Okay. Kate said no, so that's good.
Together? Sure.
Good. So, what did we talk about? What did everybody talk about? I'd like to just, you know, sort of combine our collective intelligence here, express our collective creative intelligence here for the group. Anybody want to?
There's one thing that I'm just reminded of, I didn't mention in our group, but when I had been introduced to Zen many, many years ago, the Korean monk that I had worked with, one of the stories that stuck in my mind was his invoking Dr. Zeus. And is it the heifer or who works 100%? I don't know if anybody remembers that story.
Yes, yes, yeah.
But it was wonderful, you know. So in a way, he was there asking us 100%, but he couched it in this delightful child story that's, you know, what is this 100%? It's a child's total being present or, you know. But anyway, it feels appropriate to this effort, no effort. The quandary about how you do that.
Yeah. That's nice.
I think in that story it says at the end, you will succeed 98.5% guaranteed.
No, 100%.
That's a different, that's the only places you will go.
Yeah. The places you'll go,
That's so great. That's great.
But it's true, you know, when you observe children who haven't been too already damaged and warped by expectations of good and bad and smart and dumb and all that, but if, you know, children who are just fully engaged playing, it's both effortful and playful at once. It's there's no separation.
Yeah.
It's 100%. There's no other way.
That was a question that came up for me, was when does effort feel like effort?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There seemed to be there's an element of like effort, is effort being the intention of effort because of self-criticism? Is it coming from that? And then no effort, is that, how is that an expression of just being okay with oneself, you can have effort just as an exploration of curiosity, rather than I have to do this because I want to fix something, you know. So there's that exploration, I think, that I kind of heard for myself.
What became clear for me too, when we're just talking about effort, is that both extremes of too much effort and too little effort, the same result arose, which was nothing happened. There's no gain.
Yeah.
Emptiness.
That's great. Anybody else?
This didn't come up in our discussion, but I contemplated in the week around efforting was, and I remind, my husband really likes the Taoist do by not doing. And we use that a lot in our parenting, you know, through natural consequences. And you know, it's very useful in a lot of areas. But my husband will be the first to express that he's, you know, slothful and it easily lets himself off the hook with that and that, you know, well, I'm doing by not doing, and so taking it out of context. And I think the same can you know, slip into efforting if we're looking at, similarly what you were saying, at what point are we being too critical and then efforting because we're, oh, I should, and doing the shoulds, or not doing because we're letting ourselves off the hook and just allowing. So it's, I think it's, all, for me, it has to come back to intention. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what I really Nice. Good. I think I got into overthinking with it.
How so?
Well, effort and being, like being here on this planet, there's effort to breathe, like just by being alive.
Yeah.
We're constantly needing to use effort. Effort and will is just the nature of being alive, that so if you look at practice, there's always a bit of effort to just keep interacting with gravity, even just sitting up.
Sitting upright, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, that's right.
But then I got kind of twisted up.
Well, that's interesting too, because then it's you know, and this zazen is a wonderful place where you can really explore the subtleties of that, you know, and you know, just even just the slightest adjustment in, you know, in upright posture can change your experience of zazen so completely, you know. You know, just even just straightening the back a little bit or relaxing the stomach just a little bit completely changes the energy around it too. So anybody else? I heard somebody say that it's impossible to do effort right. Did you say that? Somebody
said something similar.
Yeah. Which I thought was a nice idea. Which is kind of nice too, because then that's good to know that it's impossible. It's sort of like a vow at that point. It becomes mm-hmm. like one of the bodhisattva vows, right? Mm-hmm. It's impossible to do it right. Therefore, you know, I'm going to do it wholeheartedly.
Yeah. I maybe just touch upon one point that occurred to me as I was talking, and now it's sitting with me more, is I think if there is anything such as a true effort, it involves courage. That, you know, we can, as you said, you know, I'll make an effort, I'll clean out the fridge rather than do something, you know, something I want to turn away from.
Yeah.
That there is something about a true effort. And I don't mean that in a, like there's a false effort necessarily, but an effort that involves a kind of courage, mm-hmm. at least at that first step to even to sit on the cushion, to mm-hmm. say, I'm going to look at my life.
Yeah.
Consistent, persistent effort keeps coming back. You know that it's the daily drip, right? The daily drip of zazen, the mm-hmm. daily drip of effort. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? Like consistency.
Yeah.
Which I'm so not good at.
No, but apparently you are, though. I mean.
Well.
I keep seeing you showing up here. Every time I'm here, you're here. So.
I'm just starting to be able to tackle things gradually that I can't, you know, like can't see from beginning to end, where you can just like push through and just finish it.
Right? Yeah.
So this whole business of sort of walking towards something, you don't know where you're going to wind up, right?
Yeah.
But you just keep going,
yeah.
See what happens.
Yeah.
When you fall flat in your face or wind up in your hips and bog, then you just get out and reassess.
Yeah.
Clean up and go on.
I think that's too where the Bodhisattva vows, the fact of the Bodhisattva vows is so, you know, encouraging. You know, I mean, it is a courage question, you know. It's a matter of courage. And you know, so to make impossible vows, you know, even if you can't, there's no end in sight, you know. But there's something beautiful about that. There's something very beautiful about that and inspiring just by its very nature.
It's sort of like the closer you get, the farther away you realize you should go.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why they're inexhaustible. I was, you know, just thinking the difference between so much of the effort we make is effort that's because something says we should.
Yeah.
You know, it's externalized, and the effort that you're talking about, maybe we could call it authentic or whatever, true effort, is. This is how I want to live. This is, you know, these are the vows. This is how I want to live. And, yeah, and not knowing necessarily where it's going to lead. But that continuous renewal of intent and to not turn away from the things that we would be inclined to turn away from. Yeah. That's where the courage comes in, and sometimes it is what it takes to allow ourselves to make efforts to express our deepest, you know, heart and vow, you know, because so often there's so many ways that we sabotage that.
That kind of stuff comes up when you're not paying attention. Right? That kind of stuff comes out unselfconsciously. I just remember being thanked for something that I had no idea I did.
I was thinking about last night. Last night we did a screening of my film here, and it was a film that I made, you know, 100 years ago. No, 20 years ago, and it was about my mom. So you know, she's in it, and I knew that it was going to be emotional for me to watch it, and I didn't trust myself not to cry during it. But it's a funny film, right? There's like humorous parts in the film, and so I thought, you know, okay, this is a conundrum. You know, I'm going to give everybody permission to laugh, and I'm going to be sitting in the corner, like, you know, sobbing. You know, this is a problem. So I went and sat in the Doksan room, and I listened to the film from the Doksan room. And what I was really struck by was, you know, as I was listening to the soundtrack, because sound is such a beautiful thing, you know. If I could do it all over, I'd be a musician. But, you know, just listening to the sound of the you know, the music and the sound effects and listening to my mom's voice and, you know, all of the little bits and pieces, it just, I could see the film happening, you know. And it was extremely emotional because I remembered the effort. You know, I really remembered how difficult it was to make this film. And at the same time, how incredibly joyful it was, you know. So there was, you know, there was this incredible effort, and there was incredible pain, and, you know, there was incredible remorse about various things, and there was incredible joy. It was all of it. You know, it was all of it. And so I was sitting back there kind of, you know, remembering all of that and reliving it, you know, 20 years later, and you know, laughing and crying, and I had a great time out there all by myself, yeah, and listening,
we laughed on
yeah,
you.
That's right, and it made me so happy when, you know, I could hear everyone laughing in here, and no, I was really reflecting on effort at that point, thinking, you know, I don't know exactly what, you know, where that effort came from necessarily, but something about, you know, this particular project and about, you know, doing this thing that I needed to do, take these bones home to my mother and, you know, and reforging a relationship with her in order to make the film and all of the, you know, the things that needed to be done in order to kind of make this film come together. Pia is a filmmaker, she understands. I was thinking, wow, you know, that was a lot of effort. And it was really worth it, you know. Mm-hmm. It was really worth it, even if I can't quite yet sit in a room and watch it again. You know, it was worth it in so many ways. So that was kind of my reflection on effort, you know, in the last 24 hours. And I guess somebody else, I overheard something else in the conversations about somebody was talking about it being okay to fail, right? Mm. Does somebody want to, did that ring a bell for anybody?
Was that me?
Was that you? Yeah. Yeah. That was nice. I thought that was so important to, you know, to acknowledge that and, you know, in this, I mean, I think one of the things that prevents us from making an effort is because we're too afraid to, you know, to fail. And one of the reasons that, you know, that the courage, you know, it needs to come from a sense that it's okay to fail. You know, it's really okay. And this is one of, you know, Dogen talks about one continuous mistake, you know. And what is that from? Do you know?
Yeah, it's actually...
It's not quite that, right? It's been slightly mistranslated.
It's more like one mistake after another.
That's right.
Rather than one continuous.
Yeah. Yes, one mistake after another. Yeah. And I think that's a...
Which is life.
That's a wonderful... Right. Which is life or anything that we do. Yeah.
He says like a Zen master's life is one mistake after another.
Even better. A Zenman.
Zenman.
Zenman. Yeah.
One mistake after another.
Yeah. So that's... And Beckett says the same thing. He talks about failing better, you know, about the need to practice failing, you know, failing and then failing better. You know, so it's the same.
Yeah, I mean that success and failure is one of our biggest dualities.
Yes.
In our culture.
Exactly. Exactly.
Some of us are afraid. Some of us are just as afraid of success as of failure.
Yeah.
I think many people have find success terrifying too.
Yeah.
Right. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do we unhook that?
Yeah.
Near the beginning of your talk. I was struck by the suggestion, if I heard correctly, that Dogen would suggest embracing the extremes as, you know, and the whole range in between. And for some reason, I found myself, because I have really related to the metaphor of the string not being too tight or too loose. And so for some reason, where I am right now, I guess, the idea of, okay, go for it with the effort, you know, exaggerate and do too much effort is in there too, to be explored and experienced. So I think I might get caught up in this optimum and, you know, where is the middle? And sometimes just to be able to let go of that and spontaneously find where I'm called.
That's great. That's a great insight. I mean, I think because you know the sort of the middle of the road thing, you know, can be a lot about, you know, fear too, about, you know, about not about not wanting to get outside my comfort zone,
and doing it right.
That's right. All of those things.
Aside.
Yeah. What?
Or taking a side.
Yeah.
And standing strong in your conviction for a particular side.
Yeah.
that might appear extreme.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
thinking about social issues anything.
I just, this makes me think of a quote from Jim Hightower, who's a politician, who said, the only thing in the middle of the road is yellow lines and dead armadillos.
I was thinking about yellow lines and people changing lanes.
That's
like, careful right. out there.
That's funny.
The suffering for me is about trying to hold the dialectic in equanimity. Uh-huh. And just, you know, I often feel like, oh, it's like life is like this really, really exhausting pinball game. Mm-hmm. Like just banging back and forth and banging back and forth. And, you know, just being able to say like, oh, am I the drop of water or am I the wave or am I the ocean now? And you know, trying to be fine with all of that instead of, you know, feeling seasick. And I think that to me is sort of the struggle both of making art and practicing Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
In our group, if I can call on Leah's analogy of growing up on a farm, and effort has its seasons.
Oh.
You know, there are times when you have to get the crops in.
Yeah.
Or you don't eat next winter. So you work really, really, really hard, and you just drop at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And then there are times when the crops are all in, and you take out your fiddle. And and we're very distant from those rhythms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we expect ourselves to go flat out all the time. Mm-hmm. And here we are with all our, you know, technological aids that were supposed to free us for leisure and you know, and people are worse slaves to mm-hmm. to the workload than ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, you know, there, to everything, there is a season.
Yeah.
It's this, such a cliche, it's so obvious, but it's true.
Yeah.
With effort, too.
Yeah.
And there's times for recreating and, you know, just sitting out, looking at the garden in decay. I love looking at the decaying fall garden. I think it's really beautiful. It's all, you know, holes in the leaves and colors changing and transformation. And so I like to just go out and contemplate the fall garden. You know, so, you know, gardens can help us with this.
That's right. I mean, is the garden making an effort? You know.
No, it's just going to slime. And, you know, coming back again.
Yeah.
Just keep this image keeps coming to me, and I'm not quite sure how it fits in, but I was sitting with a friend who was dying last week, and the effort to breathe was just astounding. Like, she was so close to being dead, but for several days, just each breath was this huge effort, you know?
Yeah.
And just looking at that effort of being in a body, being alive, and I'm not sure how it fits in with this, but at one point, then the effort stopped, but there's something about there was a balance there for her being.
Yeah.
As we don't usually think of that, just sitting here breathing, just of how many efforts we're making, you know, unconsciously, and where our will is.
It goes back to that question of, you know, when does effort feel like effort,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
When does it,
yeah.
When does it become something? Yeah.
When does it turn itself?
Yeah.
In movement, physical movement, I think of appropriate effort,
mm-hmm.
and that it actually becomes grace and flow.
Mm-hmm.
It can be that. So it almost in when I see that, or the little moments I might experience something like that, it feels like effort drops away.
Yeah.
It's when it has found that place of flow.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that why we like watching the Olympics? Right? Mm. That all that stuff that they're doing looks so effortless, and you know darn well that it's not. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The incredible tension that all those athletes are under, and the outstanding performances they're giving, and
and yet it looks so graceful.
It's interesting because effort is at the heart of every story that we love, you know. That human narrative is always based around effort, you know. That without effort you can't tell a story, you know. And I think that's, you know, that's why the Olympics is so, that's the other, you know, that's part of the appeal of things like that.
To just go back to the garden or natural narrative for a second, is the garden efforting right now? No, but in the spring it sure is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the seasons are very appropriate to look at how, when, and we are so, you know, to put stress what you said, that we are so disconnected. Mm-hmm. But this is a time of turning inward because mm-hmm. that's what's happening, you know, with the natural world. And I wonder, you know, for me, that's when, so it's this time of year that I choose to deepen my practice for that very reason that there is a turning in and time to contemplate, and there's darkness. I mean, it's all there. And then as the light returns, there's more of a externalizing and a more, you know, an external effort. And the answers exist in the garden. For sure.
Well, I went through a period of, I could hear my heartbeat, or I could feel my heartbeat when I was sitting. And I was thinking about that, and my heart never takes a rest. Right? It sort of speeds up sometimes, it slows down something, but it never stops.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it's a good indication of when, you know, of how much effort you're making. Because, I mean, I know that I'm very aware of when I'm stressing myself out, you know, and because, you know, my heartbeat starts to rise, and it's a good, you know, just paying attention to that is so important, I think.
And to talk about the breath, you know, I appreciate what you said, and then about the heartbeat, and those are the two things that are, you know, our nervous system knows how to do unconsciously, so that's an unconscious effort. But both those things are there to self-regulate too when we are in anxiety or in heightened states of our central nervous system reacts to something. But, you know, and then also breath, we come in this world on an inhale and we leave this world on an exhale. And in between is that whole cycle that's ever going. And our body knows how to breathe without us thinking about it, always.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Boy. Well, good. I think that that just about uses up our time today. But thank you all for making the effort. I think that was the perfectly appropriate amount of effort to have been made today. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.